Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million. And tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Obama in Europe, tornadoes in Missouri, and Too Big to Fail, the movie. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
This podcast is supported by Carbonite Pro Online Backup, the automatic backup solution designed for small businesses. Learn more at carbonitepro.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It's Monday today, the 23rd of May. Good as always to have you with us. And we learned two things about President Obama today. One involves a pint of Guinness that we'll get to a little bit later on. The other is that there's clearly something about the president's trips to Europe that Icelandic volcanoes don't much care for. For the second time in as many trips, the president's been forced to change his travel plans because of a cloud of volcanic ash. It happened on a trip last summer, and it happened again today. The president has left Ireland a day early so as not to get grounded by the most recent Icelandic eruption. It is mostly a relationship-building swing through the continent that the president is on, ending with the G8 summit in France this weekend. He's also aiming to raise a thorny financial issue with the Europeans, more cash for the Middle East. From the European desk in London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
The president will call on Europe to pour more cash into Egypt and Tunisia. Obama will argue that it's vital to create jobs and prevent these countries from sliding back into autocracy. Ken Good is with the Center for American Progress in Washington. He says the Europeans should answer that call if they don't want a tidal wave of migrants from North Africa.
They could be looking at migratory flows into Europe as those economies continue to struggle. So it's a challenge that they're going to have to face one way or another.
But right now, Europe is facing plenty of challenges on the home front, says Simon Tilford of the Center for European Reform.
Europe is in the middle of a sovereign debt crisis, and unfortunately that is not a great backdrop for a debate about Europe's responsibilities outside of its immediate borders.
Indeed, some Brits regret the UK's military involvement in Libya. The UK is struggling to cut its budget deficit, but may soon have spent more than $1.5 billion enforcing the no-fly zone. Dan Plesch of the School for Oriental and African Studies says the Brits are suddenly feeling the effect of America's low profile in the conflict.
They, in a sense, have for years got along with riding on Washington's coattails in military expeditions without having to pick up the bill.
He says while Obama urges the Europeans to give more cash to the Arab world, the Brits will be urging him to step up America's military commitment in Libya. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
The city manager in Joplin, Missouri, said today 116 people are now confirmed dead as a result of their tornado that hit the city this past weekend. The storms were just the latest in what you might call a series of extreme weather happenings across the country this year. And Sarah Gardner reports now from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk that for the insurance industry, that means recalculating risk again.
The world didn't end Saturday, as doomsday believers predicted. But for many Americans, the floods, droughts, and tornadoes of 2011 have provided plenty of biblical-sized drama. Many climate scientists see extreme weather as the new normal. Insurers are thinking about that, too.
I think we're starting to see indications that companies are reevaluating what normal looks like.
Charlene Lurig is an insurance expert at Ceres, a nonprofit investor coalition. Lurig says the industry has been rethinking the way it does business since 1992 and Hurricane Andrew. Premiums and deductibles in U.S. coastal areas skyrocketed. Some insurers bailed out of coastal areas altogether. The nation's heartland seems safer, until the last few years, that is. Robert Hartwig is with the Insurance Information Institute.
In fact, the losses from the Midwest and parts of the South that are away from the coast have been about $10 billion on an annual basis just from thunderstorm or tornado losses. So it's almost as if the Midwest is the new coast.
Analysts expect insurance premiums will go up in states like Missouri, but insurers won't pull out. Andrew Castaldi at Swiss Re says as population and wealth expands, so do the property risks.
In the 1950s, you were lucky if each family had one car. In 2011, you know, a family of three could have three cars.
Swiss Re says average annual losses from natural disasters have climbed from $25 billion in the 1980s to more than five times that today. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Depending on how you look at it, the field of Republican presidential candidates is either shrinking, growing, or staying about the same size. Indiana Governor Mitch Daniels said no thanks early Sunday morning. Today, Tim Pawlenty, the former governor of Minnesota, announced that he's in. Donald Trump said he might get back in today. Stranger things have happened, were his actual words. They're all fighting for political support and for cash donations. The election next year is going to hinge on some big policy issues, domestic and foreign. Also, campaign finance, that is how much money the candidates raise. And with no clear frontrunner, that could spell trouble for Republicans as they try to find a nominee in what could be a billion-dollar campaign. From Washington, Marketplace's David Gura reports.
No one in the GOP is blasé about President Obama's billion-dollar goal.
Hey, back in my era, we would not have contemplated that for a dozen presidential campaigns.
That's Clayton Yeater. He was chairman of the Republican National Committee in 1991 and 92.
Fundraising is important not only in raising money, but in getting the word out.
Jim Nicholson chaired the RNC during the 2000 campaign. He says at this point, it's all about persuasion.
They have to be able to organize and inspire and motivate and convince people that they're the person and that they should help them by writing them a check.
Right now, the Republican candidates are fighting for donations, but with so many candidates, things could get messy. Fred Malik was George H.W. Bush's campaign manager, and he co-chaired the McCain campaign's finance committee in 2008. He says Republicans have to look beyond the big donors because they overlap.
There are even some people that give to multiple candidates at this stage of the game, not knowing which one is going to be the nominee, but wanting all of them to have a shot.
A successful candidate has to be able to build a new base of smaller donors. Governor Mitt Romney, who has lots of friends on Wall Street, has raised the most money so far. But Malik says you can't rule out the rest. The Iowa caucuses are still 9 months away.
You can run from behind, and you can run a successful campaign without having a financial advantage.
But he says you have to be a skilled campaigner with a strong message. And of course, the sooner the field narrows and the GOP has its nominee, the more energy and resources it can use to challenge President Obama. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
Wall Street today started low. Stay low. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Design capacity for the California state prison system is just about 80,000 people. The actual population among the incarcerated is well beyond that, almost double at one point, and has been for years now, too. Today, the United States Supreme Court said enough is enough. In a 5-4 ruling this morning, the justices said prison overcrowding here is a serious constitutional violation. They told the state to reduce its prison population by tens of thousands of prisoners in a case that was originally about inadequate medical care for those behind bars. Sam Stanton covers California prisons for the Sacramento Bee. We've got him on the line. Sam, good to have you with us.
Thank you.
Give us a sense of what this phrase, serious constitutional violation, means in terms of prison overcrowding.
Well, the Supreme Court decided that the situation inside California's prisons was essentially medieval. The opinion recounts instances of inmates dying and not being found for hours in crowded gymnasiums, of inmates being stacked in cages. One instance they recounted, there were 54 inmates using one toilet, and the court said that enough is enough, and they've either got to increase capacity or release thousands of inmates. and the odds of increasing capacity in this state obviously are non-existent given the budget crisis.
This is one of those cases that took 20-something years to get to the Supreme Court. Along the way, a lot of other states joined in, watching this very closely. 18 other states are worried about this. Explain that a little bit and talk about how this applies nationally, then.
Well, there were, as you say, there were 18 states that joined in and argued California's point. They're all worried that this will be precedent setting and that this will result in them facing pressure to release inmates. And any time you start talking about releasing inmates, there's a huge outcry from the public about public safety. Justice Scalia noted that releasing 46,000 inmates is the equivalent of three Army divisions.
You mentioned the budget crisis that we're having out here in California. So the question becomes, what can Governor Brown and the Department of Corrections do to relieve the overcrowding?
Well, Governor Brown's new plan is that they will take up to 30,000 inmates from the prisons and turn them over to the county jails. But they haven't figured out how to pay for that.
What about sending prisoners out of state? Governor Schwarzenegger did that. He sent folks to private prisons out of state, didn't he?
You're right. That's an option. There are about 10,000 inmates out of state right now in various prisons that California has sent. And the court said they could continue to do that to reduce their populations. They could send them out of state. They can send them to county jails. They can release them. They have all these different options, or they can build new prisons.
For all the money that the state of California and states all over this country spend on prisons and incarceration, is there a way to spend more money and make this problem within the bounds of resources be taken care of?
Well, I don't know. I don't know how you do it short of building more prisons or putting a halt to laws that mandate sending you away. You know, the critics complain that the three strikes law, particularly the two strikers, are filling up the prisons. And at the same time, because of the budget crisis, they have cut numerous services inside prisons, social services, you know, teaching. A lot of the people who were coming into the prisons and working with inmates no longer have those jobs. And so they've got the inmates themselves being trained to perform those services.
Yeah, there is something of a Gordian knot here, right? Because the services are being cut because of budget cuts, and yet we can't alleviate overcrowding because of budget cuts.
It all comes down to the budget, right? You have to expect some movement from Governor Brown's people to try and turn this to their favor in getting the tax extensions that they've been looking for.
That's the tax extensions the governor wants to take care of the budget crisis we're having out here.
Right. Yeah. The wall of debt.
Sam Stanton from the Sacramento Bee on today's Supreme Court ruling on prisoners here in California. Sam, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Television networks unveiled their fall schedules last week. Comedies are back, it seems, as are dramas in the 10 o'clock hour. And there's a little something else new as well. How the networks are planning to get even more ad revenue. Tie-ins between their shows and your social media. Advertisers will be able to follow you as you follow your favorite shows online. Which got commentator Rob Walker thinking about the latest new thing.
Creeped out or spooked by all the data that ad-supported web services collect? Marketers have a ready answer. This is good news, they assure us, because it means that we're less likely to be subjected to the most annoying form of advertising, pitches for stuff we don't care about. Detailed data mining means we'll only get marketing messages that are, as they put it, relevant. That's pretty good spin, and some people definitely buy it. One 40-something father I know said he'd love it if he didn't have to put up with shilling for Hannah Montana DVDs or arthritis relief products or anything else he doesn't consider relevant. But here's the problem. Micro-targeted advertising isn't really about which products are relevant to consumers. It's about which consumers are relevant to advertisers. That's different. That 40-something dad, for example, happens to have a young daughter. And the managers of any given brand intended for preteen girls could easily conclude that reaching their parents is not a bad idea. And while he may not be in the market for arthritis relief now, makers of such products might find it advantageous to start making him aware of their brand. Or suppose your online searches and clicks hint to marketing data miners that you wish you could drop a few pounds. You might prefer not to be reminded of that fact by a slew of weight loss pitches, but guess what? Those companies find you very relevant. So if they decide you need to hear more about diet pills, you will. And if you think about it, you could be just as attractive to makers of snack foods who figure you might be feeling a little peckish. We're really in the early days of learning just what advertisers will be able to figure out about any given web surfer, but you can bet they're craving all the data they can get. At some point, being bombarded with super-targeted marketing may start to feel like living with an inescapable self-portrait in data, and we'll yearn for the good old days, when ads were so irrelevant.
Rob Walker is a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine. He's also the author of the book Buying In. Send us your targeted comments. Marketplace.org is the website. Click on the link that says contact. Coming up,
what I always gravitate toward are stories where people are trying to find the better version of themselves under stress.
Director Curtis Hanson on his new HBO film, which airs tonight, Too Big to Fail. But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, you know, I was thinking it was going to be the wah-wah trombones today. Europe's debt problems helped tank stocks here at home. The Dow Industrials ditched 130 points, just over 1%, ended at 12,381. The Nasdaq chucked 44 points, about 1.5%, finished at 2,758. The S&P 500 slid 15 points, 1.2%, ended things at 1,317. Investors worry that now Spain, Italy, and Belgium might be unable to manage their debt loads without help from the European Union. Those concerns triggered a rise in the value of the dollar, which in turn helped cause the price of oil to drop. Shares of ConocoPhillips evaporated 1.75%. Chevron dribbled down 1.2%. ExxonMobil dried up about 1.1% today. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.13%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
This podcast is supported by Carbonite Pro Online Backup, the automatic backup solution designed for small businesses. Carbonite Pro automatically backs up computer files to a secure location with anytime, anywhere access from any computer or smartphone. Learn more at carbonitepro.com.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. The Commerce Department reports on sales of new homes for the month of April. A Senate Subcommittee on Aviation Operations, Safety and Security discusses air traffic control. And a conference on driverless cars gets underway in Crystal City, Virginia. The agenda covers the latest developments in intelligent vehicle technology. Imagine telling your boss you missed your ride because your car drove to work without you. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. States and counties don't have a whole lot of extra money right now. Same thing can be said for the federal government. So there is more pressure than ever now for them to get taxpayers' money's worth from the spending that they do. President Obama, the state of Massachusetts, and New York City are all testing a British idea to pay for social services, one that uses private investors, nonprofit groups, and for-profit market discipline. Alex Goldmark explains.
Social programs often require a leap of faith. The government pays to retrain the unemployed in the hope that they'll find jobs. It funds inner-city school programs in the hope of boosting graduation rates. It can take years to bear fruit. But what if the government paid for these services only if they produced results, without ever putting a dime of taxpayer money at risk? That's the idea behind something called a pay-for-success bond. The Brits call it a social impact bond, and former investment banker Toby Eccles created the first one last year.
So a social impact bond is a contract, and it's a contract which is new and different for a very simple reason. It allows governments to try to pay for outcomes that they want to happen.
In Eccles' case, the specific outcome is cutting the number of ex-cons who return to crime. Right now in Britain, over half the men released from short prison terms end up back behind bars within a year. That poor track record makes it harder to find fresh government funds for rehabilitation programs.
This solves that problem by using other people's money to do that.
Here's how the pilot project works. Instead of paying charities up front, as it usually does, the British government asked Eccles' nonprofit to manage rehab programs at one prison. Eccles raised $8 million from private investors to fund services like emotional counseling, drug therapy, and job training for 3,000 short-term inmates. The government doesn't pay a penny unless the plan works. The repeat offending rate has to fall by at least 10% over 4 years before the investors collect.
We are measuring the number of times that they get convicted in the year post their release. And we get paid for the reduction in the number of offenses that our service provision creates.
The better the results, the better the payout. Up to 13.5% annual return for the investors. Not bad for doing good. Even if the government pays investors the top rate, it's still bound to save money as the cost of jailing repeat offenders falls. And if too many ex-cons can't stay honest, it's Eccles' investors who are on the hook.
It's basically a no-lose proposition for the government.
Jeffrey Liebman is a professor at Harvard and a former White House budget official. Now he's studying how these bonds might work in the U.S.
It's really the perfect tool for these tight fiscal times where so many core services are also being cut.
The latest White House budget proposes $100 million for pilot projects using pay-for-success bonds. Massachusetts this month called for proposals to use the new concept to reduce homelessness. Liebman says these can work for most social programs as long as results can be measured. Toby Eccles adds, the new bonds finally make it economical for governments to invest in preventing social ills, not just cleaning up afterwards.
There are a whole range of social issues where if we get better at preventing them, then prevention is cheaper than cure.
Eccles says American foundations and investors are eager to finance pilot projects. And his nonprofit, called Social Finance, has opened a branch in the U.S. to get in on the action. In New York, I'm Alex Goldmark for Marketplace.
It's been, as of today, 2 years, 8 months, 9 days since Lehman Brothers went the way of bankruptcy. In that time, there have been an almost countless number of books about the financial crisis, about who did what to whom. One of them was Andrew Ross Sorkin's page-turner Too Big to Fail, which has now been made into a movie for HBO, which airs tonight. Director Curtis Hanson of L.A. Confidential and 8 Mile fame was in charge. Curtis Hanson, good to have you with us.
It's good to be here.
Why take on this project? I mean, it's a tough story to tell, this whole financial crisis.
Well, it's interesting. The Andrew Ross Sorkin wrote the book,
yeah,
as you know, and HBO developed a script from it and then sent the script to me. And my first reaction was, who's going to want to watch a movie about a bunch of guys in suits and ties sitting around a table?
Yeah.
But when I read the script, what I found so compelling was at the center of it, it was this character of Hank Paulson, who for many years was a titan of Wall Street and now as Treasury Secretary finds himself in the midst of this crisis that's spinning out of control. And the only way to deal with it that he can – that he or anybody can think of is by resorting to something that he had been philosophically against his entire adult life, namely government intervention.
Yeah, it was fascinating. I mean, William Hurt plays Henry Paulson, and you wind up by the end of this thing, and people will hear me say this and will get nasty letters, but you wind up feeling sorry for Henry Paulson, the pressure and the squeeze,
yes,
and the not knowing what else to do.
Exactly. And also the guilt.
Yeah.
You know, there's a critical scene in the movie where Cynthia Nixon, who's his liaison,
right,
to the press, asks, and what do I tell them when they ask why this wasn't regulated? And William takes a pause and says, no one wanted to. We were making too much money.
Yeah.
And you just see the guilt that he's owning, and he's miserable with it.
Yeah. The thought that kept going through my mind as I was watching this thing was I flashed back to Apollo 13, Ron Howard's movie.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Very well-known story, but you know how it ends, right?
Right.
Even though you were watching the movie the whole time, you're like, man, are these guys going to make it back? Are they going to cry? Are they going to die? Same thing here. You know how the story ends, or we know how, you know, that part of this story ends. But at the same time, there's this line of tension that,
yes,
runs through this movie that keeps you going.
Well, that's what I was trying to do, was to make it, yeah, like a suspense film.
Did you read Andrew Ross Sorkin's book at any point in this process?
Yeah, I read it after I'd read the script.
Yeah.
It's a good book. It is a good book. Yeah. We had him on the show. It was interesting. Yeah. And we should say you got him a little cameo in the movie too.
Yes.
He plays a reporter
and asks a question.
You mentioned Henry Paulson's guilt, his fear, and indirectly culpability that Wall Street had. But you come out of this after having seen Dick Fuld of Lehman Brothers and Jamie Dimon at J.P. Morgan Chase and all of these guys not able to point a finger and say, you know what? It was your fault.
Right. That was deliberate. I think it's more interesting without a black and white approach. Yeah. You know, and I looked at these guys as being men who were doing what they did. You know, they were doing the best they could for themselves and the best they could for their companies. And they didn't – none of them had the foresight to see where it was leading.
Yeah, well, that's kind of amazing, right? Because you see James Woods as Dick Fuld, the CEO of Lehman Brothers, a couple of times saying literally these words, oh, real estate's going to come back. It's going to come back.
Exactly.
And you're like, come on, man.
Yeah. He thought it was coming back.
Yeah. Was this a project for you of telling the story or was it trying to help the audience understand what happened?
It was telling a story I hope people would find interesting. And what I always gravitate toward are stories where people are trying to find the better version of themselves under stress. And that's what I felt was going on here. And I thought suspense would come out of that.
Curtis Hanson. The movie on HBO tonight is called Too Big to Fail. Thanks a lot for coming in.
Thank you.
If you don't get HBO or if you just want to see a sneak preview, we've got a couple of clips on our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, back to the president and that pint of Guinness that we started with. He stopped by the local pub in his great-great-great-grandfather's hometown of Moneygall today, had the obligatory pint of stout, after which he said, and this is a quote, "It tastes so much better here than back in the United States. You're keeping all the best stuff here," he said. To which I say, as a beer drinker, that stinks. Got to share the good stuff with us, too. It's also worth a mention, by the way, that the president was clearly thirsty, emptied the pint in just four big sips. All right, we got to go. That's Marketplace from APM American Public Media this Monday. Today, the Dow dropped 130 points, just over 1%. The NASDAQ off 44 points, about 1.5%. The S&P 500 slid 15 points, 1.2%. Our producers include Avishai Artsy, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Coming up next time, back here, a website for fantasy investors that pays real money when you win.
It's more a token of, hey, you know, we value that you played in the contest and that you beat the market.
Updown.com is the website if you want to get a sneak preview. I'm Kai Rizdal. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.